Standing, then, upon the ladder of heaven, he says to the one who was seeing this vision in a dream, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. Do not be afraid. Gen 28:13. This oracle was the goal of the practicing soul and its surest support, teaching it that the Lord and God of all things belonged, by both of these titles, to its own lineage, being inscribed and called both the God of fathers and of grandfathers, so that the whole cosmos and the lover of virtue might have the same inheritance. Since it has also been said, the Lord himself is his inheritance. Deut 10:9. Do not suppose it said carelessly that Abraham is now called both Lord and God, while Isaac's God alone is named. For Isaac is a symbol of knowledge that comes about self-taught, self-heard, and self-learned by nature, while Abraham is a symbol of knowledge acquired by teaching. And it belongs to the one to be a native and homegrown, and to the other to be a migrant and a newcomer. For having abandoned the foreign and alien Chaldean tongue of those who babble idly about astronomy, he arrived at the language fitting a rational creature, the service of the cause of all things. This character, then, has need of two powers to attend to him, dominion and beneficence, so that by the might of his ruler he might obey the laws laid down for him, and by his gracious kindness be greatly benefited, while the other has need of the power of grace alone. For he was not made better by an admonishing rule, having possessed the good by nature, but through the gifts rained down upon him from above he was good and perfect from the beginning. God, then, is the name of the gracious power. Lord is the name of the royal power. What, then, could one call an older good than to obtain unmixed and unadulterated beneficence, and what a younger good than one blended of both dominion and gift? Perceiving this, it seems to me, the practicing soul prayed a most wonderful prayer, that the Lord might become to him God, Gen 28:21. For he wished no longer to fear him as a ruler, but to honor him lovingly as a benefactor. Is it not likely that by these and similar things even blind minds might sharpen their sight, once made to see by the most sacred oracles, so as to breathe deeply and not merely skim along the surface of the words? But even if we, closing the eye of the soul, are unwilling or unable to look up, do you yourself, O Hierophant, prompt us and stand over us, and never cease to anoint our eyes, until, initiating us as mystagogue into the hidden light of the sacred words, you show us what is invisible to the uninitiated. This indeed is fitting work for you to do. But you souls, as many as have tasted divine longings, rise up as from a deep sleep, scatter the mist, and hasten toward that all-encompassing vision, casting off slow and hesitant delay, that you may perceive all the sights and sounds which the president of the contest has prepared for your benefit. Countless indeed are the things worthy of display, but one of them is what was said a little before. The oracle called him who was, by birth, the grandfather of the practicing soul, his father, yet did not apply the name of father to the one who had truly begot him. For it says, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, though this man was in fact his grandfather, and again, the God of Isaac, Gen 28:13, and then does not add your father. Was it not then worth investigating the reason for this? Certainly. Let us then examine, without carelessness, what it is. Scripture says that virtue is acquired either by nature, by practice, or by learning, and therefore recorded all three founders of the nation as wise, though they did not set out from the same starting point, but were hastening toward the same goal. The eldest of them, Abraham, used teaching as the guide of the road leading to the good, as we shall show elsewhere, so far as is possible. The middle one, Isaac, was guided by a nature that hears and learns of itself. And the third, Jacob, by the practiced exercises through which come the labors of contest and struggle. Since there are three ways by which wisdom is acquired, it has happened that the two extremes are especially united. For what comes by practice is the offspring of what comes by learning, while what comes by nature is akin to both, for it is laid down as a root beneath them all, and has obtained a prize that is unopposed and ready at hand. It is fitting, then, that Abraham, who was made better by teaching, is called the father of Jacob, who was forged by exercise. Not as man is father of man, but as a faculty of hearing, most ready for learning, is father of a faculty for practice and fit for contest. If, however, this practicing soul runs vigorously toward the goal and sees clearly, in the full light of day, what before it only dimly dreamed, then transformed into the better character and addressed as Israel, he who sees God. He no longer inscribes as his father Jacob the supplanter, nor Abraham who learned, but Isaac, the noble one born by nature. This is not a myth of my own devising, but an oracle recorded upon the sacred tablets. For it says, Israel set out, he and all that was his, and came to the well of the oath, and offered a sacrifice to the God of his father Isaac. Gen 46:1. Do you now perceive that the present discourse is not about perishable men, but as has been said about the nature of things? For behold, the very same subject is at one time named Jacob, son of Abraham, and at another time called Israel, son of Isaac, for a precisely determined reason. Having said then, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac, he adds, do not be afraid. Gen 28:13, consistently with what precedes. For how could we still be afraid, holding you, the deliverer from fear and every passion, as our defending shield, you who also gave shape to the archetypal patterns of our education, hidden until then, so that they might become visible, teaching as Abraham and begetting as Isaac. For you consented to be called the teacher of the one and the father of the other, granting to the one the rank of a disciple, and to the other that of a son. For this reason you also promised to give the land, I mean virtue, the most all-bearing and most fruitful, upon which the practicing soul lies down to rest, sleeping to the life of sense while being awake to the life of the soul. Gen 28:13. Accepting his peaceful rest, which he chose not without war and the hardships of war, not by bearing arms and killing men, far from it, but by destroying the opposing army of the passions and vices of virtue. And the offspring of wisdom is likened to the sand of the earth, Ibid. 14. Both because of its countless, unbounded multitude, and because just as the underlying sand beats back the assaults of the sea, so the reasoning of education beats back the assaults of sins and wrongdoings. And this reasoning, according to the divine promises, is extended to the very ends of the universe, and shows the one who possesses it to be heir of all the parts of the world, reaching everywhere toward the east, toward the west, the regions of the south, the regions of the north. For it is said, it shall spread abroad to the sea and to the south and to the north and to the east. Ibid. 14. The good and noble person is not merely a private good but a common good for all, offering the benefit that flows from him to everyone, freely and without delay. For just as the sun is light for all who have eyes, so too the wise man is light for all who share in rational nature. For in you all the tribes shall be blessed. Genesis 28:14. This oracle applies both to a single person with respect to himself and to one person with respect to another. For if the mind within me is purified by perfect virtue, the tribes of the earthly element around me are purified together with it. The tribes allotted to the senses, and to that greatest reservoir, the body. And if someone, whether in a household or a city or a country or a nation, becomes a lover of wisdom, that household and that city and that country and that nation must necessarily attain a better life. For just as aromatic substances, when they give off their fragrance, fill with sweetness all who come near them, in the same way all who are neighbors and border on the wise man draw in the breeze that streams from him to the greatest distance, and have their characters made better. The greatest benefit for a soul that toils and struggles is to have as its fellow traveler the God who has already arrived everywhere. Behold, he says, I am with you. Genesis 28:15. Of what wealth then could we still stand in need when we have you, the only true wealth, guarding us on the road, Ibid. That leads to virtue at every one of its turnings. For the rational life does not consist of a single part directed toward justice and the rest of virtue, but of countless parts from which, setting out, one can arrive at practical wisdom. And it is beautifully said too, I will bring you back to this land, Ibid. For it would have been good if reasoning, remaining with itself, had never journeyed out to sense perception at all, but the second best voyage is to return again to oneself. Perhaps this also hints at the doctrine of the soul's immortality. For having left the heavenly place, as was said a little earlier, the body came, as it were, into a foreign land. And he says that the Father who begot it will not overlook it, confined forever, but taking pity, he will loose its bonds and safely escort it, set free, all the way to the mother city, and will not let it go before the promises made in words have been confirmed by deeds of truth. For it is characteristic of God to say, without exception, only what is going to come to pass. And yet, what am I saying? His words differ in no way from his deeds. So the soul in training, stirred and roused to inquire about being, at first supposed that the existent was in a place, but pausing a little and growing fearful at how hard the object of its inquiry was to locate, it begins to change its mind. Jacob awoke, it says, and said, "The Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." Genesis 28:16. And it would have been better, I would say, not to know than to suppose that God is contained in something God, who himself contains all things in a circle around him. Rightly then, he was afraid and said in wonder, "How fearful is this place?" Genesis 28:17. For truly, among the topics of natural philosophy, this is the most difficult of all, the question where, and whether at all, the existent is in something. Some say that everything which subsists has taken possession of some region, different thinkers assigning it different regions, either within the cosmos or outside it, in some space between worlds. Others say that the unbegotten is like nothing that has come into being, but surpasses the whole of things, so much so that even the swiftest running thought must confess itself far outstripped and defeated in the attempt to grasp it. This is why he cried out at once, "This is not Ibid. What I supposed that the Lord is in the place." Genesis 28:16, for he contains but is not contained, that is the truth. And this visible, perceptible thing that is shown, this sense-perceptible cosmos, is therefore nothing other than the house of God, Ibid. The house of one of the powers of the existent, the power by which he was good. He called the cosmos a house, and also named it the gate of the heaven that leads toward truth, Genesis 28:17. And what is this? The cosmos put together out of the forms, the intelligible cosmos, brought into being under the divine bounty, which cannot be grasped in any other way except by passing beyond this perceptible and visible cosmos. For it is not possible to conceive of anything else among existing things as incorporeal, except by beginning from bodies. For place was conceived from bodies at rest, and time from bodies in motion. Points and lines and surfaces and limits generally were conceived from the outermost covering, as it were a garment, that surrounds bodies. By analogy, then, the intelligible cosmos too was conceived from the perceptible cosmos, being a kind of gate to it. For just as those who wish to view cities enter through gates, so all who wish to grasp the invisible cosmos are guided there by the visualization the visible cosmos provides. But the cosmos of intelligible substance, being without any shape visible to sight, will be apprehended solely through the archetypal idea imprinted in it, corresponding to the form it beheld without any shadow, once every wall and every gate has been removed from it, so that it looks at nothing from the outside, but discerns, by itself and through itself, in some ineffable and hard-to-describe act of vision, beauty that admits of no change. Enough, then, on these matters. Fitting the same category is another dream as well, the one about the multicolored flock, which the visionary, rising up after it, recounts, saying, "The angel of God said to me in my sleep, Jacob, and I said, 'What is it?' And he said, 'Lift up your eyes and see the male goats and the rams mounting the sheep and the she-goats, the streaked, spotted, and speckled with ash gray. For I have seen everything that Laban is doing to you. I am the God who appeared to you in the place of God, where you anointed a pillar to me and vowed a vow to me. Now therefore rise up and go out from this land and depart to the land of your birth, and I will be with you.'" Genesis 31:11-13. You see that the sacred word records God-sent dreams not only for those that appear directly from the most venerable of causes, but also for those that come through his interpreters and attendant angels, who have been judged worthy of a divine and blessed portion by the Father who begot them. But consider what follows as well. The sacred word, to some, gives orders like a king, commanding by decree what must be done. To others, as a teacher to disciples, it explains what is beneficial. To others, as a counselor putting forward the best opinions, it greatly benefits those who do not know on their own what is advantageous. And to others still, gently and with persuasion, like a light, it discloses much of what cannot be spoken, which none of the uninitiated may lawfully hear. And sometimes it also asks questions of certain people, as of Adam, "Where are you?" Genesis 3:9, to which one might properly answer, "Nowhere, because nothing human ever remains in the same state, but is in motion, in soul, in body, and in external things alike." Our reasonings are unstable, receiving from the same objects not the same but opposite impressions. The body, too, is unstable, as the changes through every stage of life from infancy to old age show. And unstable, too, are the things hung up outside us, tossed by the ever-shifting current of fortune. Yet whenever it comes to the council of its friends, it does not begin to speak before calling each of them by name, so that, pricking up their ears and attending in silence, they may hear what is being solemnly declared with a memory that never fades, since it is also said elsewhere. Be silent and listen. Deuteronomy 27:9. In this way, at the bush, Moses is called by name, for when he saw, it says, that he was drawing near to look, the Lord called to him out of the bush, saying, Moses, Moses. And he said, What is it? Exodus 3:4. Abraham likewise, at the holy burnt offering of his beloved and only son, both when he began the sacred rite, and when, having given proof of piety by being ready to remove from among men that self-taught race called by the name Isaac, he was stopped. For at the beginning it says, God was testing Abraham and said to him, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. And he said, Take your son, your beloved son, whom you loved, Isaac, and offer him up. And then once he had already brought the victim up onto the altar, the angel of the Lord called to him out of heaven, saying, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. And he said, Do not lay your hand on the boy and do nothing to him. Genesis 22:1-9:12. And the man in training too, being one of that friendly company, is reasonably deemed worthy of the same privilege and is called by name. For the angel of God said to me in my sleep, he says, Jacob. And I said, What is it? Genesis 31:11. Once called by name, he pays close attention, trying to grasp precisely the signs that appeared to him, and the signs consist of matings and births among words, as though they were livestock. For lifting up his eyes, it says, he saw the male goats and the rams mounting the sheep and the she-goats. Genesis 31:12. The male goat leads the herd of goats, and the ram leads the flock of sheep. And these animals are symbols of two perfect forms of reason, of which the one purifies and empties the soul of its sins, while the other nourishes it and fills it with right actions. Such are the leading reasons that guide us, like herdsmen, and the herds, fittingly named after sheep and goats, dart forward and advance eagerly toward justice. Lifting up his eyes, then, the eye of his understanding, until now closed, he saw the perfect reasonings, comparable to goats and rams, sharpened both to diminish wrongdoing and to increase the doing of what is right. And he saw how they mount the sheep and the goats, souls still young and tender, just come into bloom and adorned with the flower of their prime, not in pursuit of irrational pleasure, but sowing, invisibly, the seed of wisdom's teachings. For this marriage is blessed with fine children, joining not bodies but perfect virtues to well-formed souls. Come forward, then, all you upright reasonings of wisdom, mount, sow your seed, and whatever soul you see that is deep, fertile, and virgin, do not pass it by, but calling it to intimacy and union with yourselves, bring it to completion and make it pregnant, for it will bear all things noble, a male offspring, streaked, spotted, and speckled with ash gray. Genesis 31:10. On the power that each of these offspring possesses, we must inquire. The white-spotted, then, are the most far-shining and conspicuous, since dia is often used to mean great, from which usage it is customary to call something diadelon and diasemen, that is, greatly clear and greatly notable. He means, then, that the firstborn offspring of the soul that has received the sacred seed should be white-spotted, resembling a light that is not dim but a most far-shining radiance, such as might come, unshadowed, from the sun's rays in a clear sky at midday. He also means that they should be speckled, not in the manner of the many-shaped, ever-shifting, unclean leprosy, which through instability of judgment produces an unsteady, drifting life, but stamped with letters and diverse seals, all of them genuine, whose distinctive qualities, mingled and blended together, will produce a musical harmony. For some have supposed the art of embroidery to be so neglected and obscure a thing that they assigned it to weavers. But I am amazed not only at the art itself, but at its very name, especially when I look upon the divisions of the earth, the spheres in the heavens, the differences among animals and plants, and this whole altogether variegated fabric, the universe. For I am compelled at once to conceive of the craftsman of this entire weaving as the discoverer of the art of embroidery, and I revere the discoverer, and I honor the art he discovered, and I am struck with astonishment at the work itself. Though I have not been able to see even the smallest fraction of it, and from the part that has appeared to me, if indeed it has appeared, I precisely conjecture the whole by the hope of proportion. I marvel too at the lover of wisdom, because he has practiced this same art, judging it worthy to gather many differing things from differing sources and weave them into one. For taking from elementary grammar the first two things, writing and reading, from more advanced study, familiarity with the poets and the recollection of ancient history, from arithmetic and geometry, the freedom from deception in matters requiring proportion and calculation, from music, rhythms and measures, the enharmonic, the chromatic, and the diatonic, and again conjunct and disjunct melodies, from rhetoric, invention, style, arrangement, disposition, memory, delivery. And from philosophy, whatever these other arts have left out, along with everything else out of which the whole of human life is composed, he has fitted together one most flourishing work, mixing ease of learning with breadth of learning. And the craftsman of this web, the sacred word called Bezalel Exod, 31:2ff, whose name, interpreted, means in the shadow of God. For this man fashions copies, while Moses is the architect of the patterns themselves. And for this reason, the one sketched things as though they were shadows, while the other fashion not shadows but the archetypal natures themselves. If then, even the holy things have been constructed by the art of embroidery, and the wise embroiderer alone is spoken of in the oracles revealed by the Hierophants, and the beautiful embroidery of God, this universe, has been brought to perfection by all-wise knowledge, how is it not fitting to welcome embroidery as an instrument of knowledge? Every house of wisdom, both in heaven and on earth, will carry as its most sacred image a copy of this art, from which the one in training works out forms of varied discourses. For right after the white-spotted, he saw the speckled, marked with the stamp of education. Third are the ashen sprinkled. Yet who in his right mind would not say that these two, by kind, are speckled? But his concern is not so much with distinctions among cattle as with the road that leads to nobility of character. For he means that the one setting out on this road should be sprinkled with ash and water, because reason holds that earth and water, mixed and shaped by the molder of man, were separated out to form our body, not a body wrought by hand, but the work of an invisible nature. The beginning of wisdom, then, is not to forget oneself, but always to keep before one's eyes the elements out of which one was compounded. For in this way one might wash away arrogance, the most God-hated of evils. For who, bearing in mind that ash and water are the origins of his own coming to be, would be puffed up by conceit and carried aloft? For this reason, he also judged it right that those about to perform sacred rites be sprinkled with the things just mentioned, considering no one worthy to offer sacrifice who had not first come to know himself and grasped the nothingness of humanity, inferring from the elements out of which he was compounded that he is worth nothing. These three signs, the white-spotted, the speckled, and the ashen-sprinkled, appear imperfect in the one still in training, who is not yet perfect, but in the perfect man they themselves appear perfect as well. Let us observe in what manner. The sacred word judged it right that the great high priest, whenever he was about to perform the services enjoined by the law, first be sprinkled with water and ash, Exod. 29:4, as a reminder to himself, for the wise Abraham too, when he was about to entreat God, called himself earth and ashes, Gen 18:27, and then that he put on the ankle-length tunic and over it what is called the speckled breastplate, Exod. 29:5, a likeness and copy of the light-bearing stars in heaven. For there are, it seems, two temples of God. One is this universe, in which the high priest is his firstborn, the divine Logos. The other is the rational soul, whose priest is the man who is true in reality, whose sense-perceptible likeness is the man who performs the ancestral prayers and sacrifices, to whom it is entrusted to put on the tunic just described, since it is a countercopy of the whole of heaven, so that the universe may join man in sacred service, and man join the universe. Two types, then, he has already shown to be in his possession, the sprinkled and the speckled form, the third and most perfect, called white-spotted, we shall now indicate. Whenever this same high priest enters into the innermost part of the sanctuary, he strips off the speckled vestment and puts on instead a different linen garment, made of the purest fine linen, lev. 16:4. This is a symbol of vigor, incorruptibility, and a most radiant light. For the fabric is unbreakable, comes from nothing that dies, and, unless carelessly cleansed, has a color that is most bright and most light-like. Through these things he hints at this. That of those who serve the one who is without guile and impurity, there is none who has not first made use of firmness of resolve, having scorned human affairs, which entice, cause corruption, and produce weakness. Then aspired to incorruptibility, having laughed at all the things mortals fashion in their vain conceit. And finally been illumined by the unshadowed, all-encompassing light of truth, admitting nothing whatsoever of false opinion, which by its nature belongs to darkness. Let the great high priest, then, stamped with the three seals we have mentioned, the white-spotted, the speckled, the ashen-sprinkled, be recorded by us as such a man. But the man devoted to the constitution of human society, named Joseph, may be seen laying claim not to the extreme characters, but only to the middle, speckled one. For it is said that he had a coat of many colors, Gen 37:3, since he had neither been sprinkled with the sacred purifications, by which he might have known himself to be a compound of ash and water, nor was he able to touch the all-white, most light-like garment, virtue. But he clothed himself instead in the altogether variegated fabric of public life, in which the smallest part is mixed with truth, while many great portions consist of plausible, persuasive, likely falsehoods. The very source from which all the sophists of Egypt have sprung, augurs, ventriloquists, portent readers, men skilled at deceiving, chanting spells, and working sorcery, whose treacherous arts it is a great task to escape. For this reason, Moses fittingly introduces this coat as stained with blood, Gen 37:31. Since the whole life of the man engaged in public affairs is stained, waging war and being warred upon, struck and pierced by the unforeseen mischances that assail him. Examine, then, the man wholly devoted to the people, upon whom the affairs of the city depend, and do not be overawed by those who admire him, and you will find many diseases lurking within him and many fates hanging over him, each violently gripping his soul by the neck, secretly wrestling with it, seeking to overturn and cast it down. Whether because the multitude resents his leadership, or because of a counterattack by some more powerful man. Envy, too, is a heavy enemy, hard to shake off, always fastening itself upon what is called good fortune, and it is not easy to escape. Why, then, fastening the embroidered life of public affairs upon ourselves as though it were a costly garment, do we strut about, deceived by the outward comeliness of its visible appearance, failing to perceive its hidden and concealed disgrace, treacherous and precarious as it is? Let us then strip off this flowery coat and put on instead the sacred tunic, woven through with the embroideries of the virtues. For so we shall also escape the ambushes that lack of skill, lack of knowledge, and lack of education set against us, of which Laban is a devotee. For since the sacred word has cleansed us with the lustral waters prepared for consecration, and has adorned us with the secret teachings of true philosophy, leading us to the test, and making us distinguished, conspicuous, and radiant, it now calls to account that treacherous character, provoked to outrage by what has been said. For it says, I have seen all that Laban does to you, Gen 31:12, the very opposite surely of what I myself have granted, the thing hard to cleanse, the thing disqualified, the thing dark through and through. But one who relies confidently on the hope of divine alliance ought not to cower, since it is also said to him, I am the God who appeared to you in the place of God. Gen 31:13. It is a very fine boast for a soul to claim that God appears to it and converses with it. But do not pass over what has been said. Examine it carefully whether there really are two gods. For it says, I am the God who appeared to you, not in my place, but in the place of God, as though of another. What then must we say? The God who exists in truth is one, but those called God by extension of usage are many. This is why the sacred word here signals the true God by using the article, saying, I am the God, while it names the one so called by extension without the article, saying, the one who appeared to you in the place, not of the God, but simply of God. Here he calls his eldest Logos God, not out of superstition about the placement of names, but with a single aim in view, to deal with the matter itself. Indeed, elsewhere too, when he examined whether there is any name belonging to the one who is, he clearly recognized that no proper name exists for him, Exod 6:3. Whatever anyone says is said only by extension of usage, for he is not naturally an object of speech, but only of being. This is confirmed also by the oracle proclaimed to the one who inquired whether he had a name. I am the one who is, Exod 3:14. So that, since none of the things it is possible for a human being to grasp apply to God, he might at least come to know his existence. To the incorporeal souls who serve him, then, it is fitting that he should appear as he truly is, conversing as a friend with friends. But to souls still in the body he appears likened to angels, not changing his own nature, for he is unchangeable, but implanting in those who form the impression a semblance of another shape, so that they suppose the image to be not a copy, but that archetypal form itself. There is an old story told that the divine, taking the likeness of different men at different times, goes about among the cities in a circuit, examining acts of injustice and lawlessness. And perhaps it is not told truthfully, but it is certainly told usefully and beneficially. But the sacred word, always employing more solemn and holier conceptions concerning the one who is, while at the same time eager to educate the life of the foolish, likened him to a human being, yet not to any particular individual. And for this reason attributed to him a face, hands, feet, a mouth and voice, angers and passions, and further weapons of defense, comings in and goings out, and movements upward, downward, and in every direction. Referring the main point of these accounts not to the truth, but to the benefit of those who are learning. For there are some whose natures are so utterly dull that they are incapable of conceiving God at all without a body. There is no way to admonish such people except by telling them, in this manner, that God comes and withdraws like a man descends and ascends, uses a voice, is displeased at wrongdoing, is implacable in his anger, and has ready in advance, against the unjust, arrows and swords and all the other instruments suited for punishment. It is enough if they can be brought to their senses by the fear hung over them through such images. And these are, one might say, the only two paths of the whole legislation. One inclines toward the truth, by which it is established that God is not like a man, Num 23:19. The other looks to the opinions of the more sluggish-minded, concerning whom it is said, "The Lord your God will discipline you, as a man disciplines his son," Deut 8:5. Why then should we still be astonished if he is likened to angels, seeing that he is likened even to men for the sake of helping those in need? So when he says, "I am the God who appeared to you in the place of God," Gen 31:13, understand that he occupied, so far as appearance goes, the place of an angel, without changing, for the benefit of one not yet able to see the true God. For just as those unable to look upon the sun itself see instead the sun's reflected radiance and take it for the sun, and see the halo around the moon and take it for the moon itself, so too they perceive the image of God, his angel, the Logos, as though it were God himself. Do you not see Hagar, General Education, who says to the angel, "You are the God who watches over me," Gen 16:13. For she, being of Egyptian stock, was not capable of seeing the most ancient cause. But now the mind, as it begins to improve, comes to form an impression of the ruling power over all such powers. This is why he himself says, "I am the God whose image you formerly beheld as if it were myself, and to whom, engraving a most sacred inscription, you set up a pillar." Gen 31:13. And the inscription signified that I alone stand fast, Exod 17:6, and that I have founded the nature of all things, bringing disorder and disarray into cosmos and order, and have set my weight beneath the universe, so that it might be firmly established, upon my mighty and subsisting Logos. For a pillar is a symbol of three things: standing, dedication, and inscription. Standing and inscription, then, have been explained, but dedication needs to be pointed out. The whole heaven and the cosmos is a votive offering of God, who made this offering. And likewise, all souls that are citizens of the cosmos and beloved of God consecrate themselves, drawn aside by nothing mortal, and never tire of hallowing and offering up their own incorruptible life as a sacred gift. But foolish is the one who sets up a pillar not to God but to himself, fixing in place the things of becoming, which are shaken through and through in every part, and deeming them worthy of inscriptions and praises, things which, being full of blame and reproach, it would have been better either never to have written at all, or, once written, to have erased at once. This is why the sacred word says outright, "You shall not set up a pillar for yourself." Deut 16:22. For nothing that pertains to truth is self-standing, even if certain men, lying, should burst themselves declaring otherwise. But such people not only imagine themselves to be firmly fixed, but also think themselves worthy of honors and inscriptions, having forgotten the one who alone is worthy of honor and truly stands fast. For as they were already destroying themselves and turning aside from the road that leads to virtue, sense perception, their innate wife, turned them still further astray and forced them to run aground. And so the whole soul, wrecked like a ship run aground, was set up in the manner of a pillar. For the oracles say that Lot's wife, having turned back to look behind her, became a pillar of salt, Gen 19:26. And fittingly, appropriately so, for if someone does not look ahead at what is worth seeing and hearing, and these are the virtues and the deeds done according to virtue, but instead keeps looking back at what lies behind, at the backward and hindward things, pursuing deaf reputation and blind wealth and senseless bodily bloom and mindless beauty of form, and all that is akin to these, that person will be dedicated as a lifeless pillar, collapsed in upon itself. For such pursuits have no stability. Most excellently, then, the one in training, having learned through continuous practice that what comes into being is of itself subject to movement, while what is uncreated is unchangeable and unmoved, sets up a pillar to God, and having set it up, anoints it. For it is said, "You have anointed a pillar to me," Gen 31:13. But do not suppose that a stone is anointed with oil. Rather, understand that the doctrine that God alone stands fast is exercised and trained within the soul, by an art of anointing, not the kind by which bodies are made fat, but the kind by which the mind acquires strength and unconquerable vigor. For anyone base and fond of exercise who has set out in pursuit of noble pursuits, so that, having naturally practiced the sister art to medicine, the art of anointing, and having anointed and welded together all his arguments concerning virtue and piety, he will dedicate to God the most beautiful and firmest votive offering. That is why, after the dedication of the pillar, he says, "You have vowed a vow to me," Ibid. A vow, properly speaking, is a dedication, when a person is said to give to God as a gift, not only his own possessions, but himself, the possessor, handing himself over as well. "Holy," he says, "is the one who lets grow the hair of his head," Num 6:5, once he has made his vow. And if he is holy, he is altogether a votive offering, no longer touching anything unconsecrated and profane. My argument is guaranteed by the prophetess and mother of a prophet, Hannah, whose name, translated, means grace. For she says she gives her son Samuel as a gift to the Holy One, 1 Kingdoms 1:28, not so much a human being as a disposition, inspired and possessed by a God-born frenzy. Samuel, interpreted, means appointed to God. Why then, soul, do you still indulge in vanity and labor in vain, instead of resorting to the ascetic, to learn the weapons and the wrestling holds against passion and empty opinion? For perhaps, once you have learned, you will lead a herd, not an undistinguished, irrational, and unruly one, but a tried and reasoning and richly varied herd. If you become its leader, you will lament the pitiable human race, but you will never cease turning in supplication to the divine, nor will you fail to bless God's happiness. You will also engrave hymns fit for holy use on pillars, so that you may not only speak fluently, but also sing musically of the virtues of the one who is. For in this way, you will also be able to return to your father's house, having escaped the long and endless storm in a foreign land. In recording the third kind of God-sent dreams, we might fittingly summon Moses to our aid, so that, as he learned without having been taught, he may instruct us as well in our ignorance concerning the signs, illuminating each one. The third kind arises whenever, in sleep, the soul, moved of itself and shaking itself into frenzy, is caught up like a corybant, and, possessed and inspired with a power of foreknowledge, foretells things to come. For the first kind occurred when God originated the motion, and, invisibly, sounded within us things unclear to us but known to himself. The second, when our own mind was moved along with the soul of the universe, and filled with a God-born madness, by which it is permitted to foretell many things that are to come to pass. That is why the Hierophant disclosed the visions belonging to the first kind of signification very plainly and clearly, since God, through the dreams, was suggesting things resembling clear oracles. But those of the second kind he disclosed neither with full clarity nor in deep obscurity. An example of these is the vision that appeared of the ladder reaching to heaven. For it was enigmatic, yet the enigma was not so thoroughly hidden from those with the power to see keenly. But the visions belonging to the third kind, being more obscure than the former because their enigma is deep and thoroughgoing, also required the science of dream interpretation. At any rate, all the dreams of this kind recorded by the lawgiver are interpreted by men skilled in the art just mentioned. Whose dreams, then, are these? Surely it is clear to everyone. They are the dreams of Joseph, those of Pharaoh king of Egypt, and those which the chief baker and the chief cupbearer themselves saw. It would be fitting always to begin instruction from the first examples. The first are those which Joseph saw, receiving two visions from the two parts of the cosmos, heaven and earth. From earth, the dream about the harvest, which runs thus, I thought we were binding sheaves in the middle of the field, and my sheaf rose up, Gen 37:7, and, concerning the zodiac circle, the dream, as though the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me, Ibid. 9. The response to the first, made with vehement indignation, ran thus, Will you indeed reign over us, or will you indeed have dominion over us? Ibid. 8. And to the second again a righteous anger, Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow down to you upon the earth? Ibid. 10. Let these things, then, be laid down like foundations, and let us build up the rest, following the instructions of that wise master builder, allegory, examining each of the two dreams with precision. But there is something that must be heard before both. Some have extended the nature of the good over many things, while others have allotted it to the best part alone, and some have mixed it together, while others have left it unmixed. Those, then, who declared that only the noble is good, keeping it unmixed, assigned it to the most sovereign part within us, reasoning, while those who mixed it fitted it to three things, soul, body, and external goods. The latter belong to the softer, more luxurious way of life, having been raised for the most part from the very cradle in the women's quarters and in the effeminate habits of the women's quarters. The former, by contrast, live a hardy life, having been raised as boys among men, and being themselves manly in their thinking, embracing what is advantageous ahead of what is pleasant, and using athletic regimens aimed at strength and vigor, not at pleasure. Moses then introduces the leaders of two companies. Of the noble one, Isaac, self-taught and self-instructed, for he records him as being weaned, Gen 21:8, a man who did not think it right to make any use at all of soft and milky, infantile and childish forms of nourishment, but rather of vigorous and mature ones, since from infancy he was well suited by nature for strength, ever flourishing and growing young again, and of the yielding and easily swayed company, Joseph. For he does not disregard the virtues of the soul, but he also takes forethought for the stability of the body, and he reaches also for an abundance of external things. Naturally, he is pulled in different directions, having set before himself many ends of life, and dragged this way and that by each of them, he is shaken and thrown into confusion, unable to find a footing. For indeed his ends do not, like cities bound by treaty, keep the peace, but rather attack one another in turn, so that now one prevails and now is defeated. For often a great impulse, streaming toward wealth and reputation, overpowers the concerns for body and soul. Then, forced back again by the resistance of both, it is in turn overcome by the other. And in the same way, the pleasures of the body, breaking out altogether, flood over and obliterate everything intelligible in their path. Then, before long, wisdom, blowing back against them with a violent and forceful breath, slackens the current of the pleasures and calms altogether all the eager pursuits and ambitions that come through the senses. Such, then, is the cycle of endless war that revolves about the versatile soul. For when one enemy is struck down, another, stronger still, is sure to spring up in its place, after the manner of the many-headed Hydra. For they say that in her case, in place of the head that was cut off, another sprouted up, hinting at the many-shaped and prolific race of undying vice, so hard to capture. So then, never singling out one thing in answer regarding Joseph, know instead that he is an image of a manifold and blended sort of opinion. For there is displayed in him also the rational form of self-mastery, belonging to the male line, stamped after the pattern of his father Jacob. There is displayed also the irrational element of sense perception, imaged forth in the maternal line through Rachel. There is displayed also the seed of bodily pleasure, stamped in him by his association with chief cupbearers and chief bakers and chief cooks. There is displayed also the seed of empty opinion, upon which, as upon a chariot, he mounts because of its lightness. Gen 41:43, puffing himself up and holding himself aloft to the ruin of equality. The character of Joseph, then, is sketched out by what has been said. As for each of the dreams, we must examine it with precision, and we must first inquire into the one about the sheaves. I thought, he says, that we were binding sheaves. Gen 37:7. The word I thought is at once the utterance of someone who is unsure and hesitant and grasps things dimly, not of one who sees firmly and with clear vision. For it befits those who are rising up out of a deep sleep and are still dreaming to say, I thought, not those who are fully awake and looking on with clear sight. But the ascetic Jacob will not say, I thought, but rather, behold, a ladder was set firmly in place, whose head reached to heaven, Gen 28:12, and again, when the flocks were conceiving, I saw them with my own eyes in my sleep, and behold, the he-goats and the rams were mounting the sheep and the goats, streaked white and spotted and speckled with ash color. Gen 31:10-11. For those who hold that the good is choiceworthy for its own sake find that the impressions received in sleep are necessarily purer and clearer, just as their waking actions, too, prove the more approved. I admire it, when I hear the man telling his dream, that he supposed himself binding sheaves, not reaping. That is the work of common laborers and servants, but this is the practice of leaders and men most skilled in husbandry. For to be able to distinguish what is necessary from refuse, and nourishing from unnourishing, and the genuine from the bastard, and the most useful fruit from a useless root, not among things the earth sprouts, but things the mind produces, belongs to the most perfect virtue. At any rate, the sacred word represents those who have vision as reaping, and most paradoxical of all, not reaping barley or wheat, but reaping out the harvest itself. For it is said, when you reap your harvest, you shall not finish off the remainder of the harvest, Leviticus 19:9. For it wishes the man of worth to be not only a judge of things that differ, distinguishing the things from which each thing that comes to be, and the offspring themselves arise, but also to seem to abolish this very capacity to distinguish, reaping the reaping and cutting off his own claim to it, because he trusts and believes Moses when he says that judgment belongs to God alone, Deuteronomy 1:17. With whom lie the comparisons and distinctions of all things, by whom it is a noble thing to confess oneself defeated, more glorious than a victory, sung in song. It is like reaping the harvest to circumcise a second time, which he devised as something new when he found a circumcision of circumcision, Genesis 17:13. The purifying of purity, Numbers 6:2. The cleansing of the soul's own cleansing, yielding to God the office of making bright, and never supposing themselves able, without divine forethought, to wash and cleanse a life crowded with stains. Of this same kinship is also the double cave, Genesis 23:9. The double and contested opinions, the one concerning what has come to be, the other concerning its maker, in which the man of worth is nourished, contemplating the things in the cosmos, but also longing to know about the Father who begot it. From these, I think, the double octave was also discovered in music. For it was fitting that both the work and its maker be blessed with the most perfect melodies, two melodies, and not the same ones. For since the things celebrated in song differed, it was necessary that the melodies and harmonies too be kept distinct, assigning the conjunct scale to the conjoined cosmos fitted together out of differing elements, and the disjunct scale to God, who in his being is disjoined from all coming to be. Again, the Hierophant declares an opinion that loves virtue, saying, you shall not finish off the remainder of the harvest, Leviticus 19:9, remembering the original premise, according to which he confessed that the end belongs to the Lord, Numbers 31:28 FF. With whom lies the authority and the ratification of these things? But indeed the man uninitiated in reaping boasts and says, I supposed we were binding sheaves I had not reaped, Genesis 37:7, and did not reckon with himself that this is the service of slaves and of men without understanding, as I said a little earlier. Sheaves, when we read them allegorically, we say are the things which each person, as his own proper food, grasps at in the confidence that in it he will live and pass his existence for all time, so he hopes. Now the varieties of sheaves, I mean of the things that, as it were, nourish are countless, and countless too are those who grasp at and choose the sheaves, so that it is impossible either to name or to conceive them all. But it is not out of place to explain a few of them, by way of example, which the very man who tells the dream himself mentions. For he says to his brothers, I supposed we were binding sheaves. Genesis 37:7. Now the brothers are 10 by the same father and 1 by the same mother, and the name of each of them is a token of some most necessary thing. Reuben stands for natural gift, for he is called son who sees. As a son, he is not yet perfect, but as one who sees, sharp of sight, he stands for natural gift. Simeon stands for learning, for the name means hearkening. Levi for earnest activities and actions and holy services. Judah for songs and hymns to God. Issachar for wages, which are given in return for good works, though perhaps the works themselves were the perfect wage. Zebulun for light, since his name means a flowing away of night. For when night flows away and departs, light of necessity rises. Dan for the distinguishing and cutting apart of things. Gad for piratical attack and counterattack. Asher for natural wealth, for his name is interpreted blessing, since wealth is reckoned a blessed possession. Naphtali for peace, for by peace all things are opened up and made wide, just as they are shut in by war. And his name, translated, means a widening, or a thing opened up. Benjamin for time, both young and old. For when interpreted, he is said to be son of days. And by days and nights this age, at once young and old, is measured out. Each one then grasps at what belongs to him, and having grasped it binds together all its parts. The man of good natural gift binds together quickness of apprehension, persistence, and memory, in which natural gift consists. The man apt to learn binds together attentive hearing, quietness, and close attention. The man of enterprise binds together boldness and venturesome daring. The grateful man binds together praises, encomiums, hymns, and felicitations, both in speech and in song. The man who desires wages binds together untiring constancy, most enduring steadfastness, and diligence, together with an unrivaled swiftness. The man who pursues light instead of darkness binds together wakefulness and keenness of sight. The man who is zealous for the cutting and distinguishing of things binds together sharpened arguments, so as not to be deceived by like things as though they were the same, not to speak for favor, and to be incorruptible. The man who lies in wait more like a pirate against his adversaries binds together deceit, trickery, sorcery, sophistries, pretense, and hypocrisy, things blameworthy in themselves, but praised when directed against enemies. The man who practices being rich with nature's wealth binds together self-control and being content with little. The man who loves peace binds together good order, justice, freedom from vanity, and equality. From these, the sheaves of the brothers by the same father are bound together, while those of the brother by the same mother are bound from days and time, causes of nothing yet the cause, as it were, of all things. But the dreamer and interpreter of dreams himself, for he was both grasps at empty opinion as though it were the greatest, most brilliant, and most useful of possessions. Therefore it is first from dreams, things dear to the night, that he becomes known to the king of the region of the body. Not from the clear evidence of things plainly visible, which needs daylight for its display. Then he is proclaimed governor or guardian of all Egypt, destined to carry off second honors after the king's honors, which, before judging reason, are set down as more obscure and more ridiculous forms of dishonor upon dishonor. Then he is invested with a golden collar, Genesis 41:41-42, a conspicuous halter. A circle and wheel of endless necessity, not the sequence and order that follows in life and the connected chain of nature's affairs, as with Tamar. For hers was not a collar but a necklace, an ornament, Genesis 38:18, and also with a royal ring, Genesis 41:42, a gift, a faithless pledge of faith, contrary to the one given back again to Tamar by the king who sees Israel by Judah. For this one gives the soul a seal, Gen 38:18, a most beautiful gift, teaching that God gave shape to the substance of all things, which was without shape, gave form to what was formless, gave figure to what had no quality, and, having brought the whole cosmos to completion, sealed it with an image and an idea, namely his own logos. But that other one climbs up into the second chariot, Gen 41:43, puffed up by the swaying of his wits and by empty conceit, and he stores grain ibid. 48, keeping treasure for the body and procuring food for it from every side. And this is a heavy siege wall raised up against the soul. His very name testifies, not least, to his choice and his zeal for this way of life, for Joseph is interpreted as addition. And empty opinion is forever adding the bastard to the legitimate, the alien to the proper, the false to the true, the excessive to the sufficient, luxury to life, and vanity to living. Consider what I mean to show. We are nourished by food and drink, even if it is the plainest barley cake and spring water. What then has empty opinion piled on top of this? Countless kinds of pastries and honey cakes, and the elaborate, endlessly varied blendings of innumerable wines, seasoned more for the enjoyment of pleasure than for the sharing of nourishment. Again, the relishes necessary for eating are wild greens and vegetables, and many kinds of tree fruit, and besides these, cheese and whatever else is of the same sort. And if you like, for meat-eating people we may add fish and flesh as well. Would it not have been sufficient to roast these over coals, cooked on the spot over a fire in the manner of truly heroic men, and so partake of them? But the glutton does not confine himself to this. Taking empty opinion as his ally, and stirring up the gluttonous passion within him, he searches out and looks around for celebrated cooks and table arrangers skilled in their craft. And these men, stirring up the baits that have been devised over long ages against the wretched belly, preparing the peculiar properties of sauces and arranging them in due order, fawn upon the tongue and tame it. Then at once they hook the landing place of the senses, taste, through which, in place of a free man, a slave, a hunter after dinners, before long comes to light. Who, indeed, does not know that clothing was devised, in the first place, against the harms that come to the body from cold and heat? It is a windbreak, as the poets somewhere say, against winter's storm. Who, then, is it that fashions the costly purple robes, the transparent, delicate summer garments, the gossamer fine wraps, the garments flowered either by dyes or by the weaving of those skilled in dyeing or weaving many-colored patterns, and who outdo even the imitation found in painting? Who? Is it not empty opinion? But indeed, we also needed houses, for the same reasons, and so that we might not be harmed by wild beasts, or by men more savage in nature than wild beasts, running in upon us. Why then do we adorn the floors and the walls with costly stones? Why do we range over Asia and Libya and all Europe and the islands, searching out columns chosen for their excellence and architraves? And why do we take such trouble and pride ourselves over Doric and Ionic and Corinthian carvings, and all that those who luxuriate in these fashions have further devised, adorning capitals of columns? And why do we construct men's quarters and women's quarters roofed in gold? Is it not on account of empty opinion? And yet for sleep a soft floor was enough. Since even to this day report holds that the gymnosophists among the Indians, by ancient custom, sleep on the ground, or, if not that, then at least a pallet, a couch made of chosen stones or cheap wood. But no, ivory feet are made for the bed frames, and couches inlaid with costly shells and richly patterned tortoise shell, fashioned with great labor and expense over a long time, and some coverlets are of solid silver and solid gold, and set with precious stones, adorned with flowered patterns and sprinkled with gold, as if for display and pageantry rather than for daily use. And the craftsman of all these is empty opinion. What further need is there to seek for ointments beyond the fruit pressed from the olive? For it both softens the skin and relieves the body's weariness and produces good flesh. And if anything has become slack, it draws it tight with its firmness and instills vigor and strength no less than any other substance. But against these helpful things, the pleasant unguents of empty opinion have been raised as a siege wall. Unguents for which perfumers labor and great regions contribute, Syria, Babylon, India, Scythia, among whom the sources of spices are found. And as for drinking, what was needed more than the cup that nature herself has fashioned with the utmost artistry? That cup is our own hands, which a man, bringing them together and cupping them, and applying them well to his mouth while another pours in the drink, uses not only as a remedy for thirst, but acquires an unspeakable pleasure besides. But if some other vessel was absolutely necessary, would not the farmer's wooden bowl have sufficed, rather than the need to search out the crafts of other, more illustrious makers? Why is an unstinting abundance of silver and gold cups fashioned, if not because of vanity snorting its great pride, and empty opinion carried aloft on its swaying perch? Whenever certain people think it fit to be crowned not with laurel or ivy, not with violets or lilies or roses, or in general with any fragrant wreath of some flower, passing over the gifts of God, which he sends up through the seasons of the year, but instead hoist above their heads a crown of gold, a most burdensome weight, in the middle of the crowded marketplace, without a trace of shame, what else must we suppose them to be but slaves of empty opinion? Though they claim to be not only free men but leaders of many others besides, the day would fail me were I to go on recounting the corruptions of human life. And yet why should I speak at length? For who has not heard of these things, who has not seen them for himself? Who indeed is not worn smooth and familiar with them? So it was altogether fitting that the sacred word named addition, the enemy of freedom from vanity and the companion of vanity. For just as superfluous shoots grow up on trees, great blemishes upon the genuine growth, which farmers, out of care for what is necessary, prune away and cut off. So upon the true and vanity-free life, there has grown up alongside it the false and vainglorious life, for which, to this very day, no farmer has yet been found who has cut off the harmful growth at its very roots. Therefore, those who practice wisdom, knowing that this plastered-over thing is first pursued by sense perception and then chased after by the understanding, cry out plainly, "An evil beast has seized and devoured Joseph." Gen 37:33. But is it not a savage beast, this most tangled life of confused men, shaped by vanity, whose skilled craftsmen are greed and unscrupulousness, feasting upon all who come near it? Therefore, though they are still alive, mourning shall be set before them as though they were dead, since they reap a life worthy of lamentation and dirges. For Jacob too mourns Joseph while he is still alive. But Moses will not allow the sacred discourse concerning Nadab's companions to be mourned. Lev 10:6. For they were not seized by an evil beast, but were taken up by a rush of unquenchable and immortal light, because they cut off from their path the hesitation of delay, and consecrated in purity that ardent and fiery zeal for piety, ever eager to consume the flesh and swift to move. A zeal that is alien to created being but proper to God, coming to the altar not by steps, for this the law forbids, but wafted by a favorable wind, and escorted all the way to the circuits of heaven. As a whole burnt offering and a whole fruit offering resolved into rays of upper air. Therefore, O soul that obeys the teacher, you must cut off your own hand and power whenever it begins to lay hold of the pursuits that belong to becoming, to generation, or to merely human concerns. For often, a hand that has laid hold of the twin parts is to be cut off, Deut. 25:11-12. First, because it welcomed the pleasure that it ought to have hated. Second, because it supposed the act of sowing to belong to us. And third, because it ascribed to the thing made the power that belongs to the maker. Don't you see that when the earthy mass, Adam, touches the twin tree, he dies, having honored the pair above the one, and marveled at the thing made above the one who made it. But you, step outside the smoke and the wave, and flee the ridiculous pursuits of mortal life as you would that fearsome Charybdis, and do not so much as touch it, as the saying goes, with the tip of a finger. But when you strip for the sacred rites of service, open your whole hand and your whole power, and take a firm grasp of the doctrines of education and wisdom. For there is indeed a commandment of this kind. If a soul brings forward a gift or a sacrifice, the gift shall be fine flour, and then it adds. And taking a full handful of the flour with the oil and all the frankincense, he shall place the memorial portion on the altar. Lev 2:1-2. Was it not altogether beautifully said that it is the incorporeal soul that is about to perform this sacred service, not the twin mass composed of the mortal and the immortal? For the thing that prays, the thing that gives thanks, the thing that truly brings up unblemished sacrifices was after all one thing alone, the soul. What then is the sacrifice of the incorporeal soul? What else but fine flour, a symbol of a judgment purified by the instructions of education, sufficient to produce food free of disease and a life free of blame. From this flower, the priest, grasping with the whole hand, which is to say, with every grip of the understanding, is commanded to bring up the whole soul, having become full of the most sincere and purest doctrines, as the finest sacrificial victim, fat and rich, rejoicing in the divine light and breathed upon by the breezes that rise from justice and the other virtues, so as to enjoy forever the sweetest and gentlest of lives. For the oil and the frankincense, of which the priest takes hold together with the white wheat, hint at these very things. For this reason, Moses also established a special feast for the sheaf, not for every sheaf, but for the one from the sacred land. For he says, "When you enter the land that I am giving you, and you reap its harvest, you shall bring sheaves, the first fruits of your harvest, to the priest." Lev 23:10. And this means, when you enter, O understanding, into the land of virtue, which it is fitting to give to God alone, the well-pastured, the fertile, the fruit-bearing land, and then, having sown good things, reap them grown by the one who brings all to completion, do not first carry the harvest home for yourself. That is, do not dedicate to yourself and write your own name as the cause of what has come to be, until you have offered the first fruits to the Lord of wealth, who persuades us also to practice deeds that make for wealth. It says the first fruits of your harvest, of your own harvest, not of the land's, that we might reap and harvest for ourselves, consecrating all the fine, nourishing, and worthy growths. But the initiate of dreams, who is at once also their initiator, dares to say that his sheaf rose up and stood erect, Gen 37:7. For truly, just as spirited horses raise their necks aloft, so all who belong to the company of empty opinion set themselves up above everyone, above cities, laws, ancestral customs, the affairs of each community. Then, advancing from popular leadership to civic office, casting down what belongs to their neighbors while raising up and firmly establishing what belongs to themselves, they contrive to bring under their yoke even those free and unenslaved minds that nature has made so. For this reason it adds, "And your sheaves turned round and bowed down to my sheaf." Gen 37:7. For the lover of modesty is struck with awe at the stiff-necked man, the cautious man at the self-willed one, and the man who honors equality at the one who is unequal both to himself and to others, and perhaps not without reason. For the person of refinement, being an observer not only of human life, but of all things in the cosmos, knows how much wind necessity, chance, occasion, force, and dominion are accustomed to blow, and how many undertakings and how great pieces of good fortune, running breathlessly all the way up to heaven, they have shaken down and dashed to ruin. So he will necessarily take up caution as a shield, a kindred safeguard against suffering anything terrible from a sudden attack. For what a wall is to a city, caution is to each individual, I think.